Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling happy to be alive because
good.
I feel like so grateful today. I've just been thinking a lot about artists and how lucky we are that even though we're living in a time of incredible turmoil and disruption and injustice and struggle on so many levels, it seems to be a perpetual kind of struggle in humanity. I do feel like, thank God, we have artists. And in the past year, you and I have got to meet one of the most incredible artists who we are going to be speaking to today. And we had the great privilege of presenting her work in your group show recently in Margate in Breakfast Under the Tree. Mm-hmm. And I'd actually never met her before. And then she came down to Margate and we completely like kind of fell in love with each other, just as friends, obviously. But I just completely love her. And I love her work initially. And she's known first and foremost for the most incredibly meticulous, detailed pencil drawings, which become these really kind of life-size portraits of herself, but also figures from history and her own kind of family history. And there's this kind of sense of connectedness to the past and the impact the past has had on the present. And I've also been feeling today a bit like a herbalist because I've been hearing all about the brand new show, which is in London right now. And this exhibition is called The Seed Keepers, and it's at Tuwani Contemporary. And there's a whole theme within it of kind of looking back at the botanical studies of the 18th and 19th century. And I love all these ideas within herbalism of like community and kind of the way that it might not necessarily be based on like academic or kind of institutional training, but that it can be communal and familial, and this idea of like healing. And for me, healing through art is such a massive kind of drive and life force. So I am very excited for everyone to meet this artist. We would like to welcome to Talk Art,
Charmaine Watkins.
Hi, Charmaine.
Hello.
So nice to hear your voice.
Hello.
See you.
Oh, thanks for inviting me on the show.
Of course. Oh my God. Where are you, Charmaine? Where in the world are you?
I'm in London. I live South London.
Love
South
it.
London.
So as Rob was saying, you've just opened your first solo with your gallery, which, as Rob said, is called The Seed Keepers, and it's on till the 5th of December, and it's at Tuwani Contemporary, which is Cromwell Place in SW7.
Yes, yes, that's right. It's been quite a week. So the show opened a couple of days ago, and I'm still recovering, really. I'm just overwhelmed by how many people came to the show to support on the first day. I'm just really happy right now. Yes.
Why would you say quite a week? What has been the kind of high points, low points, the points that have surprised you?
I suppose the people that came, because it opened on Tuesday and it was an all day opening. So people started arriving at 10:30 in the morning.
Wow.
I just couldn't believe it. Yeah. And then two women independently travelled all the way from Birmingham come and see the show. And I'd never met them before. They messaged me on Instagram and said that they wanted to come down. And so, you know, things like that are really, it's really touching.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That your work is connecting to them. They didn't turn up at 10 in the morning, though, did they? That was...
well, one of them came quite early.
Oh, right.
I think she came before lunch, wow. Yes.
She was on a peak time train to see you. That's a proper commitment.
You know, Charmaine, I must just say, though, like when we had your work in Margate, we had three of your works. One was in our viewing room, and the other two were actually in the exhibition space. We literally had crowds of people around your work because there was like so much detail and so kind of like meticulous like attention to the kind of features and the clothes and just all these kind of beautiful details within the people that you're presenting in the work. Can you speak a bit about how that began for you, like your passion for drawing and making work with pencils?
Well, I suppose I've always engaged with drawing because I initially come from a design background, but must have been about 2007... 2008, I decided that I really wanted to learn how to draw the figure well. And so I started to take evening classes and I did a lot of courses at the Royal Drawing School. But it just never occurred to me that I would actually draw for a living, but it was just something that I felt that I really wanted to do. And then must have been around the end of 2013, I decided to do a part-time foundation course at City Lit. And through that course, I actually created my first life-size drawing. And I did that because I actually picked painting and sculpture as my pathways, but I had a disastrous third term in both. And I thought, oh my God, you know, I've got to make work for this end of year show. And everyone was telling me how good my drawings were. So
Why disastrous? What was a disaster?
I suppose, I mean, looking back now, I realised that I couldn't say what I wanted to say at the time with painting or with sculpture, because I've always been interested in kind of themes around ancestry, and I didn't have the language to articulate what I wanted to say at that time. So what I did was I undertook some research around where I live. I live in Bermondsey, South London, and I live near Jamaica Road, and I wanted to know why Jamaica Road was called Jamaica Road. So I did all of this research in my local history library, and I discovered that the borough that I lived in had quite strong connections with this transatlantic slave trade. So I live near, not far from Shad Thames. So all along the docks, along the river is where they brought in sugar and tobacco from the plantations. Mm. So I also did some research at the Museum of London Docklands, and there's a permanent exhibition in there, London Sugar and Slavery. So that gave me a lot more information that I needed. But I then thought, what am I going to do with all this information? And I was very close to a few people on my foundation course. And when we had our little crypt group meeting, one of them said, oh, you know, why don't you do a self-portrait? Because I was talking about how, you know, all of these connections with Jamaica, Jamaica Road. There used to be a Jamaica Tavern in Bermondsey, which was knocked down in the mid-1950s. And that tavern was frequented by people like Samuel Pepys. And then...
Oh, wow. Was it in his diaries?
Yeah, it may have been in his diaries, actually. Wow. But yes, it was one of these places that a lot of society people used to go and hang out. And also my mum's side of the family come from St. Thomas in the Blue Mountains in Jamaica. They were coffee growers. I think some members of my distant members of my family that I've never met still grow coffee. And the fact that there were a lot of coffee houses around Tooley Street. So I kind of made all these connections with my family history, but with also a wider history. Mm. So when someone suggested, why don't I do a self-portrait, I thought I could draw myself. But I didn't know how I was going to tackle it. And I had to take time off from my foundation, do a freelance gig. And it was while I was doing this freelance gig that the ideas started to formulate. And I thought maybe I could map some do some kind of a map on clothing to do with people, places. So the idea slowly developed, and then I thought, I'm going to challenge myself by doing something life-sized, because up until that point, I'd never drawn anything larger than A3 before. So that's how these kind of life-size works started. And I suppose I don't actually see them as self-portraits, but I always kind of find a subject that kind of connects to me somehow, but also have a wider cultural context. So I kind of speak about collective experiences.
Right.
So that's why I don't really see them as self-portraits, if that makes sense.
So when you're talking about the scale, why did you feel like you needed to do life-size? That was the challenge you needed to tell the story you needed to
tell? Yeah, I just wanted to challenge myself. I always, I never pick an easy route when I do anything. And I was petrified at the prospect of doing something that size. But I just thought, I just need to challenge myself. So that was the initial impetus. It was purely because I'd never done it before. So I thought,
So when you said it was a disastrous third year, it's because you'd been studying sculpture and painting and you realised in that moment you wanted to be drawing.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I did realise that I wanted to be drawing, and it felt right. When I thought about that decision, I thought, yes, this decision feels right for me. And when I actually worked on the drawing, that was it. I didn't realise that I would then go on to kind of just keep creating bodies of work, you know, on this scale. Yeah. But it just felt right in that moment to do that.
And you were talking earlier on about the idea of fabric and how you realised the body beyond just the face, which is obviously your face recurring in these portraits, but that you could sort of, you know, have messages within the clothing and within the patterns and the fabric. And there was a work which you showed in Margate called Facing the Wind, which you made actually this year in 2021, which had a number of different kind of messages like hidden within the work. And what I love about it is that it really is, it's kind of explicit because it's obviously within the work, but the more you look at it, things reveal themselves. Can you speak a bit about that particular work, Facing the Wind?
Yes, I made that work as a response to the Windrush scandal. So I don't know if people on, you know, other parts of the world are aware of, but the Windrush generation are, it's a title of people, my parents' generation, who came to Britain to live and work in the 1960s, 50s and 60s. And so many of that generation, some of them came with very, very young children. And so some of those children are the ones that are caught up in the Windrush scandal. So many of them are kind of in their mid-50s and older. So some of them, you know, they came here as babies on their parents' passport. And a few years ago, the government decided to implement this kind of hostile environment policy to try and reduce immigration. So they got caught up in that. There was a lot of paperwork that was destroyed, and so people who had gone to school in this country and had worked all their lives in this country were suddenly seen as illegal immigrants. And even though they had documentation to say, you know, that they perhaps bought a property, or they've got school photographs to say, you know, they went to primary school here and everything, you know, there was a particular document that they had to provide, which was amongst the documents that had been destroyed. So then what happened was that there seemed to have been some resolution where they, you know, the government then realised that, you know, that they've done this injustice and that people are able to be compensated. But that situation still hasn't resolved. And so at the time that I started that work, 9 people had died without having received compensation. And I was really upset about that because, you know, I think of how hard my mum worked in her generation. And, you know, if my mum were alive, you know, maybe she could have been one of these people caught up in the scandal. So it really affected me. So I felt that I needed to talk about it in this work. And so on the clothing, I kind of mapped, there's a bit across the skirt, the top of the skirt, and it's like a detail from the Yarlswood Detention Centre. I kind of put that on there.
What's that? Where's that and what is that?
It's a detention centre where people were held, and they were held there to await deportation. And some people were successfully deported and were never allowed back. And so it's not a nice place. It's got barbed wires and everything on the outside. So, yes, many people spent many months in that place and were threatened with deportation weekly. So so I put that in a drawing. Also, I decided to kind of play with archetypes. So one of the characters, she's got her back to the audience and her hand on her hip. I took her from an earlier work that I'd made called They Didn't Come to Stay. And that was my first work that I'd made about my parents' generation, because when I made that work in 2017, I think it was 2016, 2017, at that time, I didn't feel that there was enough being said about my parents' generation's contribution to this country. And then after I made that work, I think it was about 8-9 months after I made that work, then the Windrush scandal broke. So I used one of the characters from that in this work. And then there's another, the second character who you see in profile. She has these keys in her hands. I decided to make her into a figure, kind of a tarot figure, the justice archetype. So she's holding these keys and this padlock, and it's kind of, I drew it as if it's on a scale. And so on one side of the scale is this padlock, and then on the other side is 9 keys. And but if you look closely, the padlock, the lock itself can never be opened. So so that kind of comments on the fact that, you know, these people have been trying to get justice and have died without that. And then on her boot, there's the insignia of the Home Office itself. So yes, I kind of weave these kind of layers of narrative into clothing, and that way of kind of telling a story through clothing is something that I started with the very, very first life-size drawing that I did, because clothing is very important to my parents' generation. And also it seems to be a colonial thing, because I was speaking to a friend of mine whose family are from Sri Lanka. And we were talking about how important dress is, you know, to people that were born on the colonies, and this whole idea of, you know, presenting yourself well, you know, even if you don't have much, but you know, there is this need to kind of really present yourself well. And so I think to have stories told through clothing, something that you can remove, is interesting, because also as a person of colour, you can't remove your identity, you can't remove your colour, but you can remove your clothing. And so, you know, there is this thing about people projecting otherness onto you. So it's kind of, you know, these are the kind of ideas that I'm exploring through
you,
the work.
You refer to them as yeah. characters, but as Rob was saying, they do all yeah. start off as a self-portrait, but you see this self-portrait of yourself, and people, I'm seeing you now. When I saw you at the show and I'd never met you in person, I was like, oh, Charmaine, I know exactly who you are because I've seen you yes. in the work. But they are you, but you also say that they're a vehicle or like a vessel or a conduit for storytelling, but you always yes. start from yourself yes. and then, yeah.
Yes. But I don't see them as me because there's this performative aspect that I have when I'm actually making the reference images. So I work from photographs and I grid them up and enlarge them.
Oh, so you'll form these poses and stuff, like what we're seeing. Right.
Yes, I do. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a camera, there's a timer on there. And so I actually kind of get
wow,
into character.
I didn't know that.
So even when I look at these pictures, yeah, when I look at these pictures, they're not me. And certainly once I've gridded and put them on the paper, they're definitely not me anymore. And then I don't actually work from one photograph. I work from photos that are taken at different angles. So I could even be drawing from like a profile view of myself, but the person might be looking in a different direction, because when I'm drawing, I kind of approach it the same way as if there's a person in front of me. So so I treat each of the drawings as kind of individuals, and so I kind of ask the same questions as I would if I had a person in front of me. I'm looking at the form, I'm asking, you know, what is happening here at the draw line. Anatomy kind of is
body
important as well.
Body language is incredibly important, but also
yes, body language is important. So a part of that is I kind of make a statement through yeah. the poses as well.
Yeah,
about
yeah.
the figure. Yeah,
yeah. But also, what I've always found really engaging is that the gaze is always averted.
Yes.
We're never looked at directly in the eye. It's yeah. always off. It's always looking down. It's always looking away.
Yes.
What does that language give you for this?
I think it allows the viewer to really come close and look at the figure. There is that. It also creates an otherworldliness. You kind of wonder what
it's
is this
interiority,
character
isn't
thinking?
It? Yeah.
Where are they looking? Yes, there is this interiority. And I think when I observe people looking at the work and engaging with the work, they slow down because I can see that they're actually having this, their own internal dialogue with the work, because they are wondering, where is this person looking? What are they looking at? You know, what are they thinking? Those kind of questions do go through the viewer's mind.
Yeah, but I'm always thinking, what is the emotion that this person's feeling? Because we're looking at the clothing and, as you said, the body positions, yeah. and you're like, what are we as an audience picking up from their thoughts and feelings from what you're showing yeah. us? But yeah, the interiority, definitely. But there is also this kind of frozen quality, like they're captured in a
yes.
moment.
Yeah.
Like you've paused something and we're watching.
Yes, and maybe that comes from the fact, because I'd done my degree in film and I spent a good probably 10 years making shorts in my spare time. So so I really like cinema, but I do like, there's something about a frozen moment in time that I'm intrigued about. And so maybe that's kind of part of my film language.
Yeah, I love that you're saying that you sort of cast yourself yes. as these roles, and that they're,
yes.
they're your players. That it's very theatrical, and because it's life-size, we're watching actors on a
yes.
stage and it's a tableau. You know, it's something held that's telling this
yes,
story
that's right,
in that
yeah.
moment.
And I did do acting classes, actually, because I wanted to understand what actors did. I just wanted to understand the actor's process so that I could become a better director. So
what did you learn,
so
then, Charmaine? What did you learn about us actors? What do we do? We're a nightmare.
You know what? I did. Now I really, gosh, I hands, you know, you know, kind of, I really respect what you do as actors, because it's not easy. And I did this course once where we had to act but also direct each other, and I had someone who didn't know how to direct me, and that was horrible. And I said that I would never do that to anybody, because I understand now that actors don't, you know, you don't tell actor what to do. You know, you discuss the characters, and you find something that, you know, the actor has to find something that they relate to within that character in order to do
you
the
sound
story
like a
justice.
Great director. That's exactly that. There's so many that haven't got that, Charmaine. There's so many.
So I suppose in a way I'm doing the same thing, because because I never have a clear, well, occasionally I do. I mean, with Facing the Wind, there was a clear story that I wanted to tell. But even a lot of the time I have an idea of the kind of thing that I want to do. And then I have this dialogue with the characters in my drawings. And even when I do have a clear story, I still have to ask the characters, what is it they need? Because, you know, I can't impose what I feel or what I think should go in the work. I have to connect to my own feeling and to connect to the work in order to serve the story. So that's the process that I go through.
You know, it's really
when
interesting
I'm making
that because
the work.
I have always, with the works that we had in Margate, just as a starting point, like felt this kind of soul connection thing where it feels quite spiritual. There's a kind of like sense of a connection to your ancestors and maybe people from like even hundreds of years ago, and then your connection to the next generation, like what isn't here yet, like the future, which in itself is quite, there's a kind of filmic element to that, because even in that work, which is earlier, it's called The Return from 2018, where there's two women, two of your players, holding a boat, and one of the figure's face is there's kind of like three faces in one, where it's almost like they're turning their head, but it could almost be like an out of body experience, or it could be like, you know, three different people at different
it's
points.
Existential, isn't
it?
Yeah.
And that work for me is like really important.
And they're carrying a boat between them. They're taking the weight of this kind of boat between them that hasn't got any sails.
Yeah. It's this, and you feel like, it, don't you, Russ? Yeah. It's like you feel the weight of the boat. It's like, can you speak
But yet
a
their
about
clothes, their clothes work. Are sci-fi. They're like celestial beings in some ways. Yeah. There's like this kind of like pyramid sort of, like a transparent pyramid that's around one of their kind of shirts, isn't there?
Yes, that's right. So with that work, I had started some investigation into indigo and its usage on the plantations during the transatlantic slave trade. And I was inspired to make that work because I watched a film called Daughters of the Dust, directed by Julie Dash. I'd first seen that film when I was a film student in the mid-90s. And then I saw that it was on Netflix and I thought, oh, I'm going to watch it again. And it was a scene that I hadn't noticed before. And it was a scene where one of the characters is talking about, you know, working on an indigo plantation. You saw that she had blue hands. And something inside me thought, I've got to research this. So I started to undertake a huge amount of research. And I read some very difficult accounts because, you know, as you do. And it then occurred to me that so many people died without having been afforded a proper memorial. So then I thought that I needed to somehow make something that commemorated that. And then, interestingly enough, around the same time that I was making that work, there was an Art Angel commission. Taryn Simon
in Islington
had done
Islington Green. I went to it. All the wailing. All
yes,
the funeral.
In Islington.
Yeah, I walked around that in the underground car park.
Yes.
Incredible.
Yes, that was incredible, wasn't it? Yes. And so we got to meet Taryn Simon. And it was, yeah, so Occupation of Loss.
Performance.
It was performance piece with all of these mourners.
Professional
from different
mourners.
Cultural
they
backgrounds.
Get, they get brought in into funerals all over the world mourners. To kind of mourn and wail.
Yeah.
And they were all there together in this one space. You'd walk amongst them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That was incredible. And I came out of that and I thought, how can I convey a sense of loss through drawing? And so that is what I wanted to inject in this work, that kind of feeling. But at the same time, I mean, because that performance wasn't morbid in any way. There was something deeply moving and spiritual about it. And it was that essence that I wanted to try and capture in this work.
It was haunting. I mean, it was haunting and it was eerie.
It
didn't feel like death was in the room with you there. And it also felt fascinating, like archaeological, seeing all this kind of like field recordings, being able to witness them moments.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yes. Yeah. It was so beautiful. Yeah. Really, really beautiful. And I still get chills thinking about it.
Because it just started, didn't it, out of nowhere? And then it was like wailing everywhere and everyone's doing their thing. And then suddenly it just ended. Everyone ended exactly the same time and then just all walked out. And it was like, well, this is so... It was like you weren't there. It was all happening somewhere else, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And then the space felt completely different. Once they'd gone... It was a completely different space, you know. It was, it was incredible, because I didn't realise it was an underground car park until all the mourners left, and then we met the artist afterwards, and then lights went on, and I thought, wow,
it's all
okay.
Under Islington Green.
You know, then I realised where I was.
Essex Road, where they meet. Yeah.
Yes.
Can I just take you back to you? You mentioned the indigo plantation. Now that's something that's new to me. So the colour indigo.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it comes from a green plant. And the interesting thing is, there's this alchemical process to creating this indigo dye, because the dye itself has to be extracted. But it's this substance called indicans, and it's transparent. And then somehow it has to be turned into something that can then become a dye, and then when you dip the cloth into it, it's green, and then when it's exposed to oxygen, it turns blue. So nobody knows how people from different continents around the globe discovered this technique around about the same time. And in India, the way they process indigo is that they make it into these kind of gelatin blocks. But in Africa and in Japan, it's almost like a fermentation process. So they kind of have like a huge pile of leaves that slowly kind of decay, almost like the same way you make compost. And then the process is then kind of created through that kind of compost. So it's really interesting how people discovered this. And so on the plantations, how they part of the process is to use urine on it to process this dye. So it's a really interesting process. So that kind of alchemical process, this kind of process of transformation, alchemy, I kind of used that idea in that figure that's kind of looks like it's just turning its head. It's got several heads. Because then the symbols on her dress kind of relate to alchemy as well. Because in my research about...
Whose urine
indigo,
is it, by the way? Is it an animal's urine or is it human urine?
You know...
Really?
Human. Yeah, I think human. Yeah, I think
is that still the case?
As well, yes.
If you...
Yes.
So, right.
No, it's not the case. They found chemical ways of processing. But So this whole idea of alchemy and transformation, I wanted to have that figure that's looking in different directions at the same time as being this kind of conduit, this channel who's kind of between this world and the next. And then the woman next to her with the kind
yeah,
of
that's right.
almost like a space age top with the pyramid kind of please. She is someone who is kind of from the future. So she's with this ancestral kind of figure. So then it makes the whole world, the whole piece timeless because you're between the past and the present and the future. And you can't really locate where this story is. But then inside the boat, there are kind of symbols that kind of relate to something more ancient, because in my research, I discovered that indigo was used in ancient funerary rites. So even as far back as ancient Egypt, you know, people used to bury their dead in indigo cloth. And there are tribes in Mali that used to do that, the Telem. So it has this really spiritual, cosmological significance as well. So it's an interesting thing.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
And it, for your new show, which has just opened, there's this theme of kind of healing, which seems to be kind of a central theme in a way. And it's linked to herbalism, which I guess you could also associate with alchemy, because there is a sense of kind of transformational thinking or something with herbalism. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
There's often a belief, because it's not always totally seen as like medical in the same way that some medicines are. You know, like pills you get given by a doctor or something. That's almost, there's almost like an authority within that structural system that says this is like medicine.
Yeah.
But like herbalism is a different thing because it's very much rooted to different plants and the meanings of all those plants, which is totally factual. But there's also
it's
this
ancient,
kind of belief within something, and that and the power within communities and a kind of kinship between different people's beliefs, beliefs in the power of those of nature essentially.
And 80% of the world's population still rely on herbs for healing. So, you know, Western medicine is just a tiny little drop of, you know, the whole kind of thing. And so that work came about because I'd had a conversation with Tanya Kovacs earlier this year in January. She was course director
at Wimbledon.
On my MA drawing course. Mm-hmm. And at Wimbledon. And at the time, she was interested in asking artists to do some drawing research around the Elephant and Castle area. And I started to talk to her about the fact that my mum used to send me to a health shop called Baldwin's on Walworth Road. It's been there for 100 years at least. And she used to send me there to buy herbs and to buy sarsaparilla. And there's a lot of black women who send their kids there to buy stuff. So I remember, you know, kind of being a 10-year-old with this big trolley and you had to bring stuff back from there. And so it just brought back all these memories. And I thought, after I spoke to Tanya, I thought, maybe I should be looking at this kind of thing for my first solo show, it makes sense to kind of look at that and look at my parents' generation and how they kind of brought knowledge of herbs from the Caribbean here and used that to kind of help heal themselves. And, you know, that's where my research began. And so there are a couple of works, the large works in that show. One of them in particular specifically speaks about my parents' generation. So it's got figures that overlap. When I overlap figures, it's my way of talking about intergenerational and, you know, one generation passing down knowledge to the next. So in one works, you've got the elder who's seated and then you've got a younger woman who's standing and they're overlapping. And so there's some elements on there. There's crochet because I grew up with my mum and, you know, her friends doing crochet just to earn extra money, you know. And so that is kind of, there's a bit of twine that comes from that crochet that's kind of linking her to the seated figure, and then it goes around a stall and back again. So there's, and then that the seated figure is holding some plants that I remember, like sorrel and ginger. My mum used to kind of make beverage with that. And so sorrel, it's rose hip. But it's also called other things around the world, because when I traveled around Egypt years ago, they drink that as well. They call it Kelkade. And that is a very cleansing, it's a beverage, but it's very cleansing. It's a blood purifier, but also it can lower blood pressure. So now I know, I understand why I used to always suffer from low blood pressure as a child, because, you know, I was drinking a lot of this stuff.
What did you used to like, faint a lot?
She used to, yeah, she used to make lots of drinks.
But did you faint? Did you have that low blood pressure where you just get dizzy all the time?
I used to get dizzy all the time. And so I didn't realise, and clearly my mum didn't realise that, you know, it lowers the blood pressure. But I only found out as an adult that that's what it does. But yes, but it's a really nice beverage, but it's full of antioxidants as well.
Especially if you've got low blood pressure.
It's very good for you, but don't drink too much.
Yeah, but this show, exactly. The Sea Keepers, yeah. this is all works on paper. Now, you work predominantly on paper. Why is it the paper for you? And you're very specific about the certain paper you've used, because I've read about this residency you did and you couldn't get the certain paper or the certain materials that you use normally, and it kind of threw you for a bit until you just succumbed and went, I'm going to go with this. But what paper do you use, and why is paper the surface that you can tell your stories on best?
I love the surface of paper. I love the feeling, the sensory feeling of pencil on paper. There's something about that. And then also when I was learning to draw, you know, back in 2007, I'd started printmaking at that time as well. And printmakers have this obsession about paper. So and I still have that obsession. So, and then also recently, I've had to use different paper, because the paper that I used to use, they don't make it anymore. So I know. So I was quite bereft.
I used to use
Canson Moulin de Roy hot press, and it used to come on a roll. And Canson has discontinued it. So I'm really upset about that. And because it was super, super smooth paper. And also when you put watercolor on it, if you made a mistake, you could lift it quite easily. So the papers that I've used in a show, you can't necessarily lift so easily with it. But actually I've fallen in love with the new papers that I'm using now.
What's the new paper called?
So the medium-sized works, I've been using Winsor & Newton watercolour paper, and it's a very nice paper. It's a smooth paper, but it's not as smooth as I'm used to, so it took a while to get used to it. But I like the way it's got a little bit of a tooth, and it's got almost like a crosshatch kind of grain to it. And so when you make marks on paper, I like the marks that pencil make on that paper. It's just really, really nice.
I actually met someone once who makes paper, and she'd been to Japan and learnt how to make paper there, because I think in Japan there's a huge history of like paper making. And have you ever worked with Japanese paper? Did I talk to you about that before?
Yes, I love Japanese paper, and I've got some in my studio, and I do want to do stuff with it, because I have done printmaking, photo litho onto Japanese paper, and it's gorgeous. And so I've got some ideas that I want to do with, because I've got a huge role in my studio, and I do want to do something kind of printmakery-ish with it. Yes, when I have the time.
How long does each drawing take you? Because, and this show, how many works are actually in this show?
There's 14 works in the show, so two of them are life size. And normally, I normally spend a good 2 to 3 months on the big works. But with this whole body of work, I started in April, and in April I'd kind of gridded up the two big drawings. And in the beginning, I was drawing and researching at the same time. And then I got them to a certain stage, and then I thought I'd better start the medium-sized ones, because I
wanted... Do you sketch before, or do you go straight onto the paper?
With the big ones, I go straight onto the paper, and I work out ideas on the paper, and I make lots of notes. I write notes all over the drawings, and then I carefully erase when it's finished.
That's really fascinating. Have you ever released one that has notes?
You would see.
Have you ever released a work that has notes on it that people can sort of...
No. No, I've never released a work with my notes on. No, never done that. So what I did was, with this body of work, I kind of started some works, left it, started new ones, and then I got to a stage where I was working on all of them at the same time, so that I could finish them all at the same time, so that they could all have this relationship with each other.
Wow. And what I love as well is that, well, I don't love it, I find it terrifying actually, is that the bigger works, the smaller works are in frames, but the bigger life-size ones, you have the paper on ball clips, on nails hanging off the wall, which we had in Margate, which is just celebrating, obviously, the actual materiality of paper. So you can see the paper, and it kind of rolls, and like it goes with, you know, the heat and everything. But there's something kind of terrifying about that as a collector, as someone who is curating the show, of like, how are you fearful for these works out in the world, people brushing past them, and the kind of
I exhibited. Yeah, my large work, The Return, because that was in the Trinity Boy Wharf Drawing Prize exhibition in 2019. So when I was exhibiting that, I was terrified, because I was thinking, it's not framed, it's going to be travelling to all these different locations. And I was really, really scared, but I had nothing to worry about, because it was looked after. But yeah, that was terrifying for me. But now I'm not so afraid, because, you know, art handlers, you know, they're trained how to handle art properly, and, you know, and it's okay.
I actually remember when the three arrived in Margate, and they came, I think two came first and then another one came later, because you made it later, but during the pandemic, actually, because the show got placed on hold, which meant we got a third work. But I remember when they arrived and they were rolled, and we actually brought them out in the Counter Edition studio upstairs, because we have big plan chests and like areas there where we can have large bodies of paper. And we unraveled them, and I remember immediately thinking, oh, I get it now, because the paper was actually really thick, and it wasn't like the kind of paper that would crease that easily, really, unless you were like really irresponsible. And also your clips are actually really elegant, like the clips that you chose, and we had to order these specific ones that you detailed. And then when we installed it, it was all quite relaxed, actually, and I was so relieved, because it was like, so, I couldn't sleep one night, I was like so stressed about it. But the truth is, it's like, as long as you take care,
yes,
actually paper's kind of really resilient, and it's a really strong material. But it made me think about, you know, like you were talking about in that work, The Return, where you have indigo watercolour and like graphite powder and all these different materials. The one that we had in our viewing room had daylight shining on it, and it was silver wax,
yes.
And it made it look blue. But then I realised when we photographed it, it wasn't blue, it was silver.
Yeah.
But the sky, the reflections of the sky in Margate were like reflecting off the silver wax and creating this blue colour.
Mm.
It was like a total illusion, like an alchemy in itself.
Yeah. Nice when things like that happen. Really
yeah,
nice.
It's like a little magical moment.
Yes.
And why did you use silver wax, by the way?
Ah, yes. So that character, again, was referencing the first, this character that I'd had in the first Windrush drawing. So in that drawing, I was inspired by a silver point drawing by Leonardo da Vinci called The Warrior.
Mm.
And so that armor, because I actually put the armor on the character because I thought that, you know, my parents' generation, I saw them as warriors because they went through so much. So the fact that I use silver wax on that is just referencing the silver point that's in the Leonardo da Vinci drawing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And why Leonardo da Vinci? Is that someone that you look at a lot? Because I saw a da Vinci exhibition and some of the drawings were just extraordinary.
Yes. I love the fact that he was an inventor and he did so
yes.
many different things, but he kind of worked out all of his ideas through drawing. It's that kind of inventiveness that I really love about him. But also, I like to go to the British Museum, the Prints and Drawings study room, and actually look at these works and draw from them. So a lot of the time when I was on my drawing MA, I used to go there and just copy these masterworks just to understand, because the thing I like about copying other people's works is to understand how they approach drawing and just to really, you know, study their marks and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant. I always remember as a songwriter when I was a teenager, Tori Amos always doing cover versions of other songs. And at the time I was really like purist and I was like, I only want to hear the song she wrote, you know, and like as a musician myself back then, I took myself really seriously and I was like, I'm not going to do covers. But then as I got older, I began to realize it's so important
yeah.
to do cover versions and to like learn about the artistry of songwriting. And it's the same for art, isn't
yes, it?
Yes, it is. It's like, it's actually really good to sometimes mimic or imitate or copy or, you know, almost do facsimiles of other artists' work because then you can throw it all away and find your own voice later.
Exactly. And you learn so much by copying other people and seeing their process, just examining and seeing, that's how they approach drawing. And, you know, you learn a lot from that and there's something that you can take and inject into your own work. I think it's really valuable practice to do that, just to understand the craft that you're engaged in. Yeah.
And actually, who are some of your contemporary heroes, or like, do you have a peer group of people that you look up to or feel supported by or hang out with?
Yes, other drawers, Barbara Walker, Phoebe Boswell.
Barbara Walker. I just want to say that.
And Claudette Johnson.
Listening. We're hopefully going to do... Oh, Claudette, amazing.
Yes.
I love Claudette.
Yes, and there's an artist who, you know, I've recently come to know his work, Robert Pruitt. His work is just, you know, beyond... I just love his work. I just absolutely love his work. He's an American... based artist, but
he's a friend of mine. I know him really well. He's
love
amazing.
His work, my goodness. Yeah. Wow, yes. And Toyin Oditola, who you've interviewed
yes.
before.
Yeah,
and I was so
Oditola.
Pleased to
Incredible.
Be in the same show as hers, you know, in Margate. It's
yeah, she's
great.
An extraordinary artist and
yeah.
an extraordinary human. Who was the artist you said after Barbara Walker before
Phoebe Boswell?
Oh, Phoebe Boswell,
yes.
of course. Yes.
Yes.
Sorry, I think I spoke over you. I didn't want to
yes.
miss her out because I
yes.
felt like she got a shout out and might not have been heard. Phoebe Boswell, she's amazing as well.
So talking about the drawing and
yeah.
the process, I, when I've been watching a few videos online and obviously how meticulous this is, I really worry for your back and your wrists. And it makes me think about that. But I know that you are very, you have a lot of stamina because you are into fitness. And I also read that you like to have a little dance in the studio before you start working, which I love. But how do you maintain this sort of, you know, the positions you must get into when you're doing all these drawings? You must be kind of hunched over and everything. How do you maintain the studio practice?
Yes, it is hard work. With the life-size works, they are pinned to the wall. So I actually work, you know, so it's vertical, completely vertical. The ones that I, the smaller ones, I have to kind of hunch over. So I do have to, every morning I kind of get up, I meditate, do yoga. I've got a Pilates reformer, so I'll go on that if I need a good stretch. So, so yes, it is hard, but yeah, it's tough on the hands. And I had to have thumb surgery as well this year, which meant that I couldn't draw for a month, which was hard. And the thumb is still healing. It still gets a bit sore because I was told it's going to take, you know, up to 2 years to completely heal. So yes, it does take a toll.
Was that from art? Was that an art injury, though? No, it wasn't. Or was that something else?
No, I had this weird growth. I don't know what it was, but, you know, and yeah, had to have it removed. So I don't know what that was. Doctors don't seem to know either. So, yeah.
On your drawing hand?
Yes, I am. Right-handed. It's my drawing hand. Yeah.
Oh,
I know.
No.
Yeah.
That's a bit
scary. It was really scary. Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to say, this show that's coming up, that's on right now, that people can go and see on till the 5th of December, is the first time that you've used all full colour.
Yes.
Because we've seen a lot of works that are graphite, are black and white, but this one is the time that you've actually introduced colour fully, and gold as well was features a lot.
So it was scary because, I was using new paper, using full colour, I switched pencils as well. So it was scary. I just, jumped into this unknown territory. But it felt right. I mean, I'd been wanting to use colour for a while, but I just didn't know how I was going to do it because my drawings are really delicate. And so it is about striking a balance between the graphite and the colour. I didn't want one to dominate the other. And it's quite easy to kind of have colour that's too strong for my drawing. So I suppose over a 2 year period, I had been kind of dipping my toe in using colour and kind of doing little experiments, but was never happy with it. But I think what forced me, I knew I had to engage in colour because you can't speak about plants and not use colour. I felt anyway. So, so I think that the fact that I was working towards this solo show, it really got me to focus my mind and it really got me to just, in the beginning, just experiment and play. And I just found the right balance. And then the paper that I was using, this new paper, I quite liked the way it interacted with the watercolor as well. Mm. 'Cause all the different papers, it kind of receives the color differently. So I think that perhaps when I'd experimented before, the paper that I was using and the way I wanted to interact with it and the drawing and the watercolour wasn't quite the right mix, but somehow it came together in this work. So, yeah.
I really like the references in this particular body of work in the new show to kind of like Afrofuturism as well, and also kind of like ancient Egypt as well as ancient African culture. Like there seems to be
pyramids,
a myriad of influences and references which are so rich but also so unique to your work. I feel like it's very much your kind of perspective and interest.
Yes. So the Afrofuturist elements is these six plant warrior women.
Yeah.
And so plant warrior women, yes, they are six women, plant warriors, and they came out of the idea that plants have their own level of spiritual development.
Wow, yeah.
And that just like humans. So I wanted to then explore what each of these plants symbolically could embody in human form. Mm. And I looked at plants that my parents' generation would have used. So it's aloe, cerise, sage, castor, ginger, and burdock.
Mm-hmm.
So with all of these plants, I did extensive research on what planetary system they kind of belong to, because each plant is connected to different planets. And I looked at plant symbolism and even tarot, because there is, I found this tarot deck that relates to different herbs and plants as well. So all of that symbolism I kind of weaved into these warrior women. And the way they're sat as well, I kind of mirrored the way the elders in the life-size drawings were sitting as well. Because if you look at a lot of photography from my parents' generation, a lot of them had studio photographs taken and they were very formal. There's this particular way that a lot of black women used to sit, you know, with their legs crossed at the ankle and, you know, the hand kind of rested in the lap. So I kind of mirrored that in all of the plant warriors as well, and gave them this very regal pose. And through the titles, it's almost like each of the titles are like a message that these plant warriors want to give to the viewer.
So brilliant.
Wow.
So that's how I approached it.
How do you know when a work is finished?
When it doesn't speak to me anymore.
So this is the conversation you're having with your characters. What you're having, this dialogue you're having, so when there's like, what, a silence?
When there's a silence, that's it. I know it's done. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then how do you feel about them going out into the world? Now you're getting collectors, and I know that there's been museums looking at the work now. And
yes, I do get sad, particularly with the big ones, because they take so long to make. So, but thankfully, you know, some of them have gone into museums, so I can go and visit them. But yes, it's you know, it's always nice when someone wants to buy your work anyway. So it's a pleasure that I can give something out to the world to someone who wants to collect it. I mean, it's a nice thing.
It's wonderful. I'm really happy your work's going into museums, because I think your work, more than anybody's, like, it looks great in photographs, but when you see it in real life, it's just got a whole other dimension. And it's so extraordinary. Yeah. Just like the trace of you, even, like, you know, all those intense marks, you know, that you, on those large works that you've spent months on, they're kind of like, I don't know, it's just this energy force on the paper, which is just next level. I love it so much.
Can you draw yourself without needing a mirror now, or needing photographs? Do you know, because you've drawn yourself so often now?
Yes, but I still approach the drawing as if I'm drawing a new person, because if you notice in my drawings, even though they all look like me, they all look complete, they all look different.
Yeah.
Mm.
So, because if you look at the plant warriors, I did one drawing and then I traced and then transferred that image to the other sheets of paper, so the eye line and everything would be exactly the same. Mm. But if you look at each of the plant warriors, they all look different. So every time I approach a drawing, I approach it as if I'm looking at that person for the same time. And every time I look at reference images, I notice something else anyway. Right. And I'm asking different questions on different days. I might be thinking, well, how is the light falling, you know, on that cheekbone, and kind of really examine that bit of the anatomy.
Yeah.
And then, so that kind of makes a difference to that work. Whereas with the other one, I might be focused more on the eyes or the position. Sometimes I slightly move the eyes as well, because when I'm gridding up, you know, once the drawing's on the paper, I then think, does it work as a drawing? Because it may have looked okay in the photograph, but does it work as a drawing.
God.
So we ask every guest two questions. The first is, if you could do an art heist and take home any artwork or building or anything you'd like from around the world, what would it be and why?
Anything by Klimt from his gold period.
Wow.
Because of the symbolism. Just a huge fan, huge, huge fan.
So it's not just ancient Egypt.
I've never seen any of his work. Yeah.
It's Klimt.
And I've never seen any of his work up close. I'd love to. That's on my bucket list to go.
This gold is appearing in this work now. Like the backgrounds behind him are fully gold on some of them.
My God, I'm glad we asked that question now. I hadn't really thought about Klimt. It makes total sense.
Yeah.
You need to get to Vienna. Yeah. Oh my God, you should do a show at Succession. That would be so cool.
Yes.
Do you know what I love about the location of where your show is on right now is it's right near the Natural History Museum and the V&A. So this whole kind of history and plants and archaeology and pyramid, everything that is kind of playing into the location where you're shown. That's amazing.
Yeah.
The other question we ask is, what is your favourite colour?
I'd have to say indigo. Yes. And I love that colour because when you kind of dilute it, you get so many different blues from that one indigo. It's just magical. It's just magical. There's something about it. And I think it's a colour that everybody loves because that's the that's the popularity of blue jeans, you know, that indigo colour. There's something about that colour that people connect to.
And do you always, when you see it or work with it, consider the history and maybe the problematic past of that colour, but also the history of that must be so embedded in that material for you when you choose to use it?
Because when I use it now, I tend to kind of think about the cosmological kind of significance of it. So yes, because it appears in a couple of the works that's in my show at the moment. So yes, I suppose yes, unconsciously I am kind of thinking about those things. Yes.
Cool. What is the best advice that you've ever received when it comes to your art?
Well, best advice actually was when I was on my foundation course, because I came from a graphic design background. So I was struggling with responding to ideas instead of answering a brief. So because I was so used to answering a brief, I was really struggling. And
well, you were a shoe designer, weren't you, at one point?
I was, yeah. Yeah, I've had many lives. So on this course, I was lucky enough to have a tutor who also came from a graphic design background. And he said to approach the work as if it's a poem. And he said, you know, that it's almost like if you take apart the idea completely, you know, you're just trying to find that essence of what you're trying to say. Because with poetry, you don't actually explicitly say that I am saying X, Y, and Z. You kind of hint at what you're saying. It's that kind of poetic response. And so that's the way I've approached the work. And I think that's why a lot of the work that I make is quite ambiguous, because I know that I don't have to be explicit in what I'm saying. I can just layer things. I can layer meanings. So that was a really, really good piece of advice to approach it like that, because I think sometimes my brain, the kind of design brain, does kick in sometimes when I'm in the studio and I think, no, right, just rip apart that whole concept and see what's left, and then just start with that. It's like starting with a little seed and just, you know, seeing how it grows.
I love that.
Yeah,
that's amazing, the poem side of it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I guess some of your works, or a lot of your work, are kind of embedded with your own secrets, your own sort of little stories that you've put in there that you don't need people to know, but they're there for you.
Exactly. And this is the thing that I needed to get my head around, because as a designer, you're supposed to spell everything out so that everybody understands, so there's no ambiguity, and you know, it's like there. and you know, having worked in advertising, you have to say it several times over as well. And so now I know that I can just be complete opposite, and it doesn't have to kind of make sense in a linear way, but it can just hint at things, and then it adds richness, and people can then bring their own kind of perspective to the work as well. And I'm always interested in what other people have to say about the work, because they always see things that I don't. And that's really interesting too.
Well, we hope as many people as possible go and see this show, The Seed Keepers, which is on Cromwell Place, a Tuani contemporary, and more people discover your work and project themselves onto it and lean into it and learn more and discover you more, because you're wonderful. And I saw your work at Tuani before. You was in a two-person show with Andrew Pierre Hart.
Yes.
That was called Tunes of the Blues, and I stumbled across that gallery. I hadn't really known gallery before. Walked in and I was like, who is this? This work is incredible. And then when the group show come up, I said, Charmaine's got to be in this show.
Aww.
I was like, it was an instant like pang of, this is really special.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
It's also been such a joy to get to know you on a friend level. Like, I loved our time in Margate when you came up the second time. I think you came like two or three times during the show.
Yes.
We had such a laugh.
Mm. I did.
And Tracy
yes.
got to meet you as well. She loved you. And I don't know, it's been so much fun.
You're going to start to get recognised. The more people know your work, they're going to be like, I recognise you. They're going to get starstruck around you. We are.
I haven't seen the show in London yet, but I'm coming up next week just especially to see it, because I cannot wait to be there.
Let me know when you're coming. I'll be there as well. I can talk you through as well.
All right. Yes. Well, thank you for listening, everyone. For images of everything we've spoken about today, you can go to TalkArt, at TalkArt on Instagram. And Charmaine, are you on Instagram?
Yes, I am, at Ms. Watkiss.
We will link to you as well. And then, do you have your own website as well? I thought you did.
Yes, I do, CharmaineWatkiss.com.
And then you can go to Tuani Contemporary. We'll also link to them, who are an amazing gallery in London, very supportive, bringing lots of new artists to all of our attention. So big respect to them as well. We actually met one of the women from Tuani at Donatella Versace's party, didn't we, Ross? I love any opportunity to mention that we met Donatella. Thanks for listening. We'll be back very soon. Bye.
Thanks, everyone. Cheers, Charmaine.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.